A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's asking about the places that still tolerate indoor smoking, the real outliers to the global trend, and what the numbers look like on smoking rates worldwide. The gap between what laws say and what people actually do is where this whole thing gets interesting. Let's dig in.
It's a gap that's wider than most people realize. I was reading the WHO's 2025 Global Tobacco Report, and 14 countries showed stalled or even reversed progress on smoking reduction. We're not talking about a solved problem. We're talking about one that's getting more complicated.
Imagine lighting up in a hospital lobby or a government office. In 2026, that's still legal in parts of the world. Not just ignored, legal.
So let's frame this. As of 2024, 74 countries have what the WHO classifies as comprehensive indoor smoking bans. That's the global norm, at least on paper. But enforcement varies wildly, and then there are the countries that never really signed on to begin with.
Then there's Israel, where we live. 2019 ban on smoking in public places, and yet walk into most bars in Tel Aviv or Jerusalem, and you'll find someone lighting up.
Israel is actually a perfect case study for the enforcement gap. The WHO's 2024 smoke-free scorecard gives Israel an enforcement score of 68 out of 100. That's not terrible globally, but for a country with a comprehensive law on the books, it's a pretty big gap between legislation and practice.
68 out of 100. That's a solid D+ in American grading terms.
Which means the law exists, but the muscle behind it doesn't. So here's how I want to structure this. We're going to look at the actual outlier countries where indoor smoking remains legal or widely tolerated, then dig into enforcement gaps even where bans exist, and finally look at the global rate trends. Because the numbers tell a story that's more nuanced than smoking is going away.
Three-part journey. Let's start with the countries that never really bought into the ban trend. Where exactly can you still light up indoors without consequence?
Let's start with the biggest outlier. Indonesia. No national indoor smoking ban at all. And the numbers are staggering. 67% of Indonesian men smoke, according to the 2023 Global Adult Tobacco Survey. That's not a typo. 2 out of 3 adult men.
67%. That's not a smoking rate. That's a cultural default.
Here's what makes Indonesia so striking. Smoking is allowed in schools and hospitals in practice. There are some local regulations in places like Jakarta and Bogor that restrict smoking in public buildings, but enforcement is minimal and there's no national framework. You'll see teachers smoking in school courtyards, visitors lighting up in hospital waiting areas.
How does a country get to that point? What's the mechanism?
First, the tobacco industry is deeply embedded in the economy. Indonesia's tobacco sector contributes about $12 billion annually to GDP as of 2024. That's enormous. It employs millions of people in farming, manufacturing, and distribution. The political resistance to regulation is intense because any ban is framed as a jobs killer.
$12 billion buys a lot of political cover.
Second, there's a cultural dimension. Indonesia has this concept of gotong royong, communal tolerance and mutual cooperation. It's a positive value in many contexts, but it gets weaponized in the smoking debate. The argument is that restricting smoking is antisocial, that it's imposing on personal freedom and communal harmony. So even when local regulations exist, social pressure works against enforcement.
Communal tolerance as a shield for individual harm. That's a fascinating inversion.
The health consequences are severe. Indonesia has one of the highest rates of smoking-related illness in Southeast Asia. The WHO estimates that over 230,000 Indonesians die annually from tobacco-related diseases. But the cultural and economic inertia is enormous.
That's the most extreme case.
And this one surprises people because Germany is often grouped with other Western European countries that have strict bans. But Germany's system is a patchwork. The 2008 Federal Non-Smoker Protection Law was supposed to create a national standard, but implementation was left to the individual federal states, the lender, and several of them created massive loopholes.
I've heard about these. The smoking clubs.
This is a genuinely creative legal workaround. Bavaria's 2008 ban had an exception for private clubs, so bars simply re-registered as private smoking clubs. You pay a nominal membership fee at the door, sometimes literally €1, and suddenly you're in a private establishment where smoking is permitted. There are over 2,000 of these in Munich alone.
Over 2,000? In one city? So the ban exists and doesn't exist simultaneously. It's Schrödinger's regulation.
And the German Constitutional Court has upheld this system. In 2014, there was a challenge, and the court essentially said the states have the right to regulate this as they see fit. So you have this bizarre situation where Germany appears on lists of countries with smoking bans, but in practice, you can smoke indoors in thousands of establishments across Bavaria, Berlin, North Rhine-Westphalia.
The appearance of compliance without the substance. It's like adopting a feral cat and calling it domesticated.
It creates a class dimension, too. The Rauscher clubs tend to be working-class bars, the kind of neighborhood establishments where regulars have been smoking for decades. The upscale restaurants and corporate venues comply with the ban. So you get this split where smoking indoors becomes associated with a particular social stratum.
Which makes it harder to regulate, because now you're not just fighting the tobacco lobby, you're fighting a cultural identity.
Let me give you another one that surprises people. Japan.
Japan's interesting because they actually did pass a law.
The 2018 health promotion law banned indoor smoking in principle, but the exceptions are enormous. Tiny traditional coffee shops, kiseten, and small bars under a certain square footage are completely exempt. Smoking rooms in larger restaurants remain common and widely used. And here's the crucial detail. The ban applies to cigarettes, but heated tobacco products like IQOS exist in a separate regulatory category.
The law created a market incentive to switch products rather than quit.
And the market responded. IQOS adoption reached 30% of Japanese smokers by 2025. Sales grew 40% year over year from 2022 to 2025. Japan's smoking rate only dropped about 2% from 2018 to 2024. People didn't quit. They just switched to a product the ban doesn't cover.
That's a harm reduction story that also happens to be a regulatory failure story. Two things can be true.
Japan's cultural relationship with smoking is unique. The kiseten exemption wasn't an accident. It was a deliberate carve-out to protect a cultural institution. These are small, often family-run coffee shops that have been around for decades, where the regulars smoke and read newspapers and the owner knows everyone's order. Legislators explicitly didn't want to destroy that.
The law was written with nostalgia built in.
And it raises a real question. When does cultural preservation justify a public health exemption? There's no clean answer.
What about the Middle East? Egypt comes to mind.
Egypt is a case study in paper laws versus reality. The 2007 law banned smoking in public places. On paper, it's comprehensive. In practice, enforcement is near zero. A 2022 survey found that 85% of Cairo cafes had active indoor smoking. Shisha cafes operate completely openly. They're not hiding, they're not registering as private clubs, they're just ignoring the law and nobody stops them.
85% non-compliance is not an enforcement gap. That's a shrug.
Shisha is culturally central in Egypt. It's not just nicotine delivery, it's a social ritual. Cafes are where deals get made, where friends gather for hours, where the water pipe is passed around. Regulating shisha is seen by many Egyptians as regulating social life itself.
Which brings us back to the enforcement question. If a law is universally ignored, is it really a law?
This is the legal philosopher question, but practically speaking, no. And Egypt's not alone. Let me give you one more outlier, Russia. Russia passed a fairly strong anti-tobacco law in 2013, but it was weakened in 2020. Smoking is now allowed in designated rooms in airports and train stations. And in regions like Chechnya and Dagestan, enforcement is essentially non-existent. Local authorities don't prioritize it, and the federal government doesn't push.
Russia's smoking rate is still quite high, isn't it?
Around 40% of Russian men smoke. It's come down from the Soviet-era peak, but it's stubbornly high. And the 2020 rollback was explicitly framed as a pandemic response measure. The argument was that designated smoking rooms would reduce crowding outside buildings. Whether that was genuine or just an excuse to weaken the law is debated.
The pandemic is regulatory cover. That's a pattern we've seen in other contexts.
Those are the big five outliers. Indonesia with no national ban, Germany with the Rauscher Club loophole, Japan with the cultural exemptions and the heated tobacco gap, Egypt with the enforcement vacuum, and Russia with the deliberate rollback. Different mechanisms, same result, you can still light up indoors in all of them.
What unifies these cases? Is it economics? Culture? Weak institutions?
It's usually a combination. Indonesia is the clearest case of economic capture. The tobacco industry is simply too big to fight politically. Germany and Japan are cultural stories where the exceptions were carved out to protect specific social institutions. Egypt is institutional weakness plus cultural resistance. Russia is a mix of political calculation and regional autonomy.
None of these are small countries. We're talking about hundreds of millions of people living in places where indoor smoking remains a fact of life.
Indonesia alone is the fourth most populous country in the world. Add in Egypt, Russia, and the gray zones in Germany and Japan, and you're looking at well over 500 million people.
The smoking is banned everywhere. Narrative is, charitably, incomplete.
Those outliers are fascinating, but they're not the whole story. Even where bans exist on paper, enforcement gaps create a parallel reality. Let's look at the numbers behind the gap.
Before we shift, one thing I want to flag about Indonesia. You mentioned the $12 billion GDP contribution, but what's the counterfactual? If those 67% of men weren't smoking, what would the healthcare savings look like?
It's hard to quantify precisely, but the WHO estimates that for every dollar the tobacco industry contributes to an economy, smoking-related healthcare costs and productivity losses consume between $1.50 and $2. So the net economic effect is almost certainly negative, but that's a long-term distributed cost. The $12 billion is concentrated and immediate, which makes it politically more salient.
Concentrated benefits, diffuse costs, the classic political economy trap.
And that dynamic shows up in the enforcement gap data too. Let me walk through the global numbers. The WHO's 2024 Smoke-Free Scorecard evaluated enforcement in 42 countries that have comprehensive laws on the books. The finding, all 42 scored below 50 out of 100 on actual enforcement.
Wait, all of them?
All 42. Comprehensive means the law covers all public places, workplaces, and public transport. But enforcement is a different thing entirely. The scorecard looks at factors like whether there's a dedicated enforcement agency, whether fines are actually issued, whether there's systematic monitoring. And across the board, even countries with strong laws are falling short.
Having a law and enforcing it are almost entirely decoupled.
In many places, yes. Let me give you a striking example, India. India passed a comprehensive ban in 2008. In cities like Mumbai and Delhi, compliance is around 80%, not perfect, but meaningful. But a 2023 study found that 60% of rural Indian restaurants still had active smoking areas, 15 years after the ban.
So the ban is essentially urban, only in practice.
India's rural population is about 900 million people. So we're talking about a huge number of people for whom the national ban simply doesn't exist in daily life. Enforcement resources are concentrated in cities because that's where inspectors are. That's where media attention is. That's where political pressure lives.
The geography of enforcement. If you can't see it from the capital, it's not happening.
This pattern repeats. Canada. Quebec's 2020 enforcement audit found 40% non-compliance in bars. This is Canada, a high-income country with strong institutions. Israel, as we mentioned, scores 68 on enforcement, better than most, but still leaving a significant gap.
What does 68 actually mean in practice? What's happening on the ground in Israel?
It means inspectors exist and fines are occasionally issued, but there's no systematic monitoring. Enforcement is largely complaint-driven. If someone calls the municipal hotline, an inspector might show up. But bars and cafes know this. The risk of getting caught on any given night is negligible, and the fines, when they're issued, are often treated as a cost of doing business.
The parking ticket model of regulation. You factor the occasional fine into your operating costs and keep doing what you're doing.
And there's a social dimension in Israel specifically. Smoking is still very common in social settings, bars, cafes, outdoor seating areas that are technically enclosed. The social norm hasn't shifted as much as the law has. So you have a situation where lighting up in a bar doesn't carry social stigma, which means other patrons rarely complain, which means enforcement never gets triggered.
The law changed, but the culture didn't. That's the enforcement gap in a nutshell.
That's why Israel is such an interesting case. It's not an outlier in the way Indonesia is. Israel has a comprehensive ban and wants to enforce it, but the social infrastructure for compliance isn't there yet. It's a window into what the gap looks like in a country that's trying.
Let's talk about the global rate trends. You mentioned the decline is slowing.
The headline numbers, the WHO reports that adult smoking prevalence dropped from 22.3% in 2007 to 17% in 2023. That's a real decline, about 5 percentage points over 16 years. But the rate of decline is slowing. Since 2020, it's been dropping at only about 0.3 percentage points per year. At that pace, we're looking at decades before we get close to elimination.
0.3 points a year is glacial. What's causing the slowdown?
First, the low-hanging fruit has been picked. The countries that were most receptive to smoking bans and public health campaigns, Australia, the UK, Canada, Scandinavia, have already seen their biggest drops. The remaining smokers are in countries with weaker regulatory frameworks or stronger cultural resistance. Second, the tobacco industry has adapted aggressively, particularly in Africa.
Africa's rates are rising?
Yes, and this is one of the most concerning trends. Cameroon is the clearest example. Smoking prevalence among 15 to 24-year-olds rose from 8% to 12% between 2018 and 2023. Tobacco industry marketing targeting youth doubled in that same period. The industry is explicitly pursuing the same playbook it used in Asia and Latin America decades ago: heavy marketing, price discounting, and political lobbying against regulation.
12% of young people. That's the next generation of the market being built in real time.
Cameroon isn't alone. Across sub-Saharan Africa, smoking rates are rising as tobacco companies invest heavily in the region. The economic argument is the same one Indonesia uses: jobs, tax revenue, economic development. But the public health infrastructure to handle the consequences isn't there.
Meanwhile, what's happening at the other end? Which countries are actually succeeding?
The UK has been the standout. Smoking rates dropped about 5% since 2020, driven by a combination of high taxation, plain packaging, aggressive public health campaigns, and the rise of vaping as a cessation tool. Ireland is the gold standard on enforcement, score of 95 out of 100 on the WHO scorecard. They funded inspectors, they made enforcement systematic rather than complaint-driven, and they built a culture of compliance over two decades.
Ireland went from being synonymous with smoky pubs to being the global enforcement leader. That's a generational shift.
It shows what's possible when enforcement infrastructure matches legal ambition. Ireland's 2004 ban was controversial when it passed. There were protests, predictions of pub closures, claims it would destroy social life. None of that happened. Compliance built gradually, and now smoking indoors is rare. The key was funding. Ireland didn't just pass a law and hope for the best, they allocated real resources to enforcement.
The formula is: pass a law, fund enforcement, give it two decades. Simple but not easy.
Not every country has Ireland's institutional capacity or political will. Which brings me to the knock-on effect. Where smoking bans are enforced, what happens? Do people quit or do they find alternatives?
Japan suggests they find alternatives.
Japan is the clearest case. The indoor smoking restrictions drove a massive shift to heated tobacco products, not to cessation. IQOS, Plume, Glow. These products are legally distinct from cigarettes in Japan, so they're not covered by the indoor smoking ban. 30% of Japanese smokers had switched to these products by 2025. The smoking rate barely budged.
The ban reduced exposure to secondhand smoke from cigarettes, which is a genuine public health win, but it didn't reduce nicotine addiction.
And this is the harm reduction debate in a nutshell. Heated tobacco products are almost certainly less harmful than combustible cigarettes. They don't produce tar, they don't involve combustion, the aerosol has fewer toxicants. But they're not harmless, and they maintain nicotine dependence. Public health communities are split on whether this is a win or a trap.
It's a win for Philip Morris, which owns IQOS. Let's not lose sight of that.
The tobacco industry is positioning heated tobacco products as the solution to the problem they created. And in markets like Japan, it's working. The EU is watching this closely. The 2026 EU Tobacco Products Directive revisions may close the regulatory gap that allows HTPs to be treated differently from cigarettes.
The industry is always one step ahead of the regulators. Ban smoking indoors, they invent a product that isn't technically smoking. Ban that, they'll invent something else.
This is the harm reduction loophole I mentioned earlier. As smoking bans tighten, vaping and HTPs become the new frontier. The question for policymakers is whether to treat these products as harm reduction tools to be encouraged or as a new front in the same war.
Depends on whether you believe the industry's intentions have changed. I'm skeptical.
The evidence supports skepticism. The same companies that denied smoking caused cancer for decades are now asking us to trust them on harm reduction. But the products themselves are different from cigarettes in terms of risk profile. It's an uncomfortable middle ground.
Let's talk about the smoking everywhere. Perception versus reality. Most people in developed countries probably assume indoor smoking is essentially gone. What's the actual picture?
It's highly uneven. If you live in Sydney or Dublin or New York, indoor smoking is rare. If you live in Jakarta or Cairo or rural India, it's ubiquitous. But even in high-income countries, there are pockets. Nevada still allows smoking in casino floors. Louisiana has significant exceptions for bars. Parts of Canada, as we mentioned, have enforcement gaps in bars and clubs.
Nevada casinos are a fascinating case. The gaming industry argued for decades that a smoking ban would destroy revenue. Has that borne out?
Some studies show minimal revenue impact from partial bans, but the industry remains resistant. The political power of casino operators in Nevada is enormous, and they've successfully fought off comprehensive bans. So you have this situation where a tourist from California, where smoking is banned in virtually all indoor spaces, walks into a Vegas casino and is hit with a wall of cigarette smoke. It's disorienting.
The smoking everywhere outliers are shrinking but not disappearing. That seems to be the bottom line.
The number of countries with no indoor smoking restrictions at all is small and getting smaller. But the number of countries with significant enforcement gaps, what the WHO calls de facto tolerance zones, is much larger. And those zones are where the real public health challenge lives.
What does this mean for someone who travels, works in policy, or just wants to breathe clean air? Let's get concrete.
First, for travelers, know the de facto rules, not just the law. The WHO publishes smoke-free country profiles, updated in 2025, that include enforcement scores. Before you assume a country's ban is enforced, check the score. Germany looks compliant on paper. In practice, if you walk into a Munich bar, you should expect smoking.
The law is the menu. The enforcement score is the meal.
Second takeaway, for policymakers, the data is crystal clear that enforcement infrastructure matters more than law strength. Ireland didn't succeed because its law was uniquely well-written. It succeeded because it funded inspectors, created systematic monitoring, and built a culture of compliance over time. Countries that pass ambitious laws without enforcement budgets are essentially writing symbolic legislation.
Symbolic legislation is the political equivalent of a New Year's resolution. Feels good in the moment, changes nothing.
Third takeaway, for the informed audience, watch the harm reduction loophole. As smoking bans tighten globally, the tobacco industry is pivoting hard to vaping and heated tobacco products. The 2026 EU Tobacco Products Directive revisions are going to be a major regulatory flashpoint. Whether these products get treated as cigarettes or as a separate, lower-risk category will shape the next decade of tobacco control.
For the average listener who wants to actually do something with this information,
the most practical thing is to check local enforcement data. The Tobacco Control Laws database at tobaccocontrollaws.org is publicly available and tracks not just what laws exist, but how they're enforced. If you live somewhere with a ban but weak enforcement, advocacy for enforcement funding is probably more impactful than pushing for new legislation. Most places don't need more laws. They need the existing ones to actually work.
The unsexy work of implementation. Nobody gets a headline for funding inspectors.
That's where the health outcomes actually happen. A law on the books that nobody follows is just words. An inspector who shows up at a bar and issues a fine changes behavior. Multiply that by thousands of inspections over years, and you get Ireland. Don't fund them, and you get Egypt.
We've got the outliers. Indonesia, Germany, Japan, Egypt, Russia. Each with a different mechanism for resisting the global trend. We've got the enforcement gap, which turns comprehensive bans into partial realities across dozens of countries. And we've got global rates declining but slowing, with Africa emerging as the new battleground.
The open question, will the next decade see the last holdouts fall, or will cultural resistance and industry lobbying create permanent gray zones?
My instinct is permanent gray zones. The tobacco industry is too adaptive, and cultural attachment to smoking in places like Indonesia and Egypt is too deep. But I've been wrong before.
There's a potential game changer on the horizon. The 2025 WHO Framework Convention on Tobacco Control Conference in Geneva proposed binding enforcement metrics. If those get adopted in 2027, countries would be accountable not just for passing laws, but for demonstrating actual compliance. That could reshape the outlier map significantly.
Binding enforcement metrics. That's the kind of bureaucratic innovation that sounds dull, but could actually matter. Suddenly, a country can't just pass a law and claim victory. They have to show results.
It would create political pressure in exactly the places we've been talking about. Israel scoring 68 on enforcement becomes a diplomatic talking point, not just an academic footnote. Egypt's 85% non-compliance becomes a measurable failure rather than a vague observation.
The gap between law and practice is where the real story lives, and it's bigger than most people realize. That's the thread running through this whole thing.
It's also a story about how change actually happens, not in clean legislative moments, but in the messy, uneven, culturally contested space between what the law says and what people do.
Before we wrap, we've got a new segment on the show.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
Cantonese has 6 distinct tones, while Hokkien has 7 or 8, depending on the dialect, meaning that in the early Renaissance, when Portuguese traders first reached the South China Sea, they encountered a linguistic landscape where the same syllable could carry more tonal distinctions than there were notes in a Gregorian chant. Meanwhile, Suriname's official language is Dutch, a legacy of the same era of European expansion that brought those traders eastward.
Thank you, Hilbert.
A lot of geography in one fact.
Gregorian chants to Suriname in under 30 seconds. The man has range.
Here's the thought I want to leave listeners with. The global trend is toward less smoking. The numbers are clear on that. But the pace is slowing, the industry is adapting, and the enforcement gap means hundreds of millions of people still live with indoor smoking as a daily reality. The question isn't whether smoking will eventually decline. It's whether we're looking at another generation of preventable illness before it does.
Whether we're willing to fund the unglamorous work of enforcement, or just keep passing laws and hoping for the best.
Thanks as always to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. This has been My Weird Prompts.
If you want more episodes, we're at myweirdprompts.com. New episodes every week. Tell someone who'd find this interesting.
See you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.